Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 349, side 2, August the 25th, 1978. Angry and disgusted at the way the Patty Hearst case is going, I think I could do the next 20-week tapes on new evidence of the Patty Hearst story since I wrote my article in 1974. But we'll talk about the case on this side of this tape, and next week, hopefully, I'll do an hour on Evel Younger. He's the gentleman that's running for the governor of the state of California, who's set up the Office of Criminal Conspiracy Section in the Los Angeles Police Department, and it was in the Criminal Conspiracy Section that Donald DeFries worked, along with Louis Attaquin. And he's running for governor, and he had a very important part in the SLA and in the California violence, and it's a good continuation to go into Evel Younger at this time. Eric Younger, the son of Evel Younger, was on the courts in Los Angeles when the Harrises had their trial down there, and he's so much a part of the counterintelligence of the right-wing terror that has taken over this country, and particularly this state. I understand that F. Lee Bailey has been threatening, blackmail Patty, tell more, break a client-lawyer relationship. Partly I get frustrated because the Hearst never got in touch with me in the 4 years that I've done all this work, and I've published articles in the Bay Area and been on the radio many, many times. But again, in all fairness, KGO Radio has never allowed me to talk about Evel Younger or Patty Hearst. I can talk about the Kennedy assassination or Watergate, but I've been blacklisted from various radio announcers there, and I was told once that Evel Younger had actually been at the building. His office is across the street, the federal building, and Charlie Bates of the FBI was always in contact with the various people at KGO, Ron Owen and Owen Spann and Jim Eason and the whole gang. And it's very hard in the Bay Area. There's some word out from the intelligence community or whatever. I don't know how it passes through, that all the links of the CIA to the kidnapping of Patty Hearst are not about to be disseminated. And the only hope would be that her parents would help cooperate with this information, but the fact is that Randolph Hearst works now with a private think tank group, a very arch-conservative group from Stanford Research, and has never gone into the links of the scientists from Stanford Research that had anything to do with the kidnapping of his own daughter. It's just impossible to get through these people. The Harrises keep asking for that mental test that Patty have. The victim of a kidnapping should be given a mental test when she's sounding more sane than she's ever been. Is just outrageous. And of course, they have delayed their trial again. They'll keep stalling and installing their trial, the Harrises, the kidnappers, until Patty is either dead or crazy, and then there won't be anyone left to prosecute them. And Stephen Weed was in the apartment when they came and took Patty. Why don't they let him testify? Do they ask him for a mental test? Or is he just taking a powder and he's anonymous? Well, on the other side of this tape, I talked about Leo Chern and that little green book of his of spies and his being on the International Rescue Committee. There's an article about him in February 1976. This was after he lost his little book, in the New York Times, when he was appointed to this new CIA committee to investigate, quotes, abuses of the CIA in the United States. And Leo Chern was described in this article as belonging to a very private humanitarian organization that received some 15,000 that they knew about from the CIA in his International Rescue Committee in the mid-60s. And Chern denied that his International Rescue Committee knew that the money was coming from the CIA. But Mr. Frank Wild, president of the International Rescue Committee, said that a mysterious man came to them in 1963 or 64 and passed $15,000 through the Norman Foundation from the CIA to the Rescue Committee. This Rescue Committee is supposed to be one of Leo Chern's hobbies, and he has raised over $3 million a year for the committee. He's an economist who is associated with the Citizens Committee for Free Cuba, part of the anti-Castro Cuban group of the Central Intelligence Agency and a council against communist aggression. He's chairman of Freedom House, a rescue group that monitors and reports about other countries in the world, and Freedom House receives money from the CIA Foundation, the J.J. Kaplan Fund. And also, Mr. Chern wrote a book in 1942 called Adjusting Your Business to War. I'm sure that's very practical, and he would know about that. In May of 1963, just a few months before John Kennedy was killed, there was a conference in New York City of Freedom House, and a new group was formed, that group called Citizens Committee for Free Cuba. And he not only was interested in freeing Cuba, but worked with the Vietnamese CIA agents that came into this country through his International Rescue Committee, and worked closely with the China lobby and other members of the American Security Council, such as Claire Booth Luce of Time magazine, and also, as I said, on the other side of the tape, and the other tape that Michael Casey went to Southeast Asia under the press passport of Time magazine and came home with Leo Chern's book and of spies and had used it in some way in contact with Judge Carter at the time of the Patty Hearst case. In a book put out on the Hudson Institute, the Herman Kahn, he's the director of this Hudson Institute. He worked with RAND Corporation and Northrop Aviation and the Stanford Research Institute, Herman Kahn. And one of the directors of the Hudson Institute is Leo Chern, Research Institute of America and Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Now, Herman Kahn not only is head of the Hudson Institute that advises the Pentagon and all defense agencies and has Leo Chern on his board of directors, but in keeping with the article that I wrote, the SLA is the CIA, here's a quotation of Herman Kahn in 1976 talking to the police convention in Los Angeles. Now, keep in mind that Ed Davis, head of the international police from all over the world, had a convention, and the guest speaker was this Herman Kahn, who was associated with Leo Chern, and it was the Los Angeles Police Department that also had employed Donald DeFries. This is what Herman Kahn said at the meeting. It was in the Los Angeles Times, and quote, "A change is taking place after dominance for the past decades of Eastern liberals, transcendentalists, Jews, Episcopals, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Quaker, Unitarians. These liberals did their best to wreck the country by embracing a set of values that did little to solve the country's problems. These values included emphasis on risk aversion, comfort, safety, health, ecology and environment, social justice, welfare, security, the quality of life, happiness, and hedonism. I would argue there's nothing wrong with these values, but you can't run a country on them. We are now going to a conservative turn. Square values, square politics. This is the year of very square. The country is basically conservative." Now, that is Herman Kahn from the Hudson Institute, who works with Leo Chern, whose list of agents fell in the hand of Michael Casey, who was dealing with Judge Carter at the time of Patty's trial. And that's what the SLA COINTEL operation was about. The Operation Chaos was to get all those groups in the Bay Area in San Francisco, the farmers, the Venceremos, the Chicanos, the women's movements, the United Farm Workers, the United Prisoners Workers, the Indian Movement, single out the leaders, identify them, infiltrate them, discredit the Berkeley anti-war protesters, and those people working for, as he says, equality, ecology, environment, and social justice. They closed the department at Berkeley, I forget, the criminal department that was fairly liberal in studying criminal justice. And these are the kinds of people from the Pentagon who are changing our domestic policy radically, and they needed the SLA and the Los Angeles Police Department and the SWAT teams to create this, foment this body in the prison system. Patty was just a pawn, like you play a chess game. She was just used as a pawn in these maneuvers for them to come down on the youth and bust in, as I say, into communes and harass and arrest. It's a complicated social structure, but everyone on the fringe of this and in the middle of it is linked to the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI. That's what I wrote in 1974, and this is Herman Kahn speaking in 1976, and Leo Chern working with Michael Casey in 1975 and 1976. There's an attorney for radicals that I absolutely detest, almost as much as Mark Lane. His name is William Kunstler. I don't trust him. I never have. Kunstler was invited to a devout Baptist meeting in Dallas, Texas, and I keep quoting this, and he said he couldn't fire the gun himself, but it's a good thing John Kennedy was killed, because he should be killed. He was a menace to this country. Well, Kunstler goes around with these so-called radicals that always end up straight or end up in jail. He defended the Chicago 7, and Sherman Skolnick, whom I respect tremendously, has broken down the sources of almost every person in the Chicago 7 trial as being agent provocateurs. He went on to wound a knee. He hasn't helped the Indians much since. He shows up at a few trials of blacks, a black woman in the South that escaped from jail. He was down there with her. He's with the Indians, but social changes don't come about through William Kunstler, and the defendants still seem to end up in jail or just as badly off. I don't know what his liberalism, if it's liberal, is really doing, and I suspect him of being a deep cover fascist. I don't think there's a liberal bone in Kunstler. Now, some of you won't like that remark of mine, but that I've observed him for years, I've heard him, and I really consider him an enemy to the truth that I'm trying to open up. And Kunstler was in Los Angeles representing Emily and William Harris, not as their attorney, but for Leonard Weinglass, to raise money for their trial. And he was lashing out at Patty Hearst and saying that people won't give Harris a fair break, that the Hearsts have all the rights, and that because she's a Hearst, that Emily William Harris just won't get a chance in this system. He said the Harris's chance for justice under the American judicial system has been aborted by the Hearst connection and the orgy of mass media coverage, the SLA syndrome. Now, the SLA demanded that all their messages be read on the radio or Patty would be killed. They demanded that they get national coverage, that these messages be printed. They demanded the use of the media. They took the daughter and granddaughter of one of California's most famous families and got all this massive publicity, and then claimed that this is an orgy of mass media. To take a college student like that and kidnap her and then have her stand in front of cameras with machine guns and leave these messages at radio stations and in boxes and demand they be printed and spoken on the air. And Kunstler came out and questioned the legal system of justice in America as against what Patty Hearst gets. And he never goes into the fact that a person was kidnapped. It doesn't matter whether Patty is the richest girl in America or the poorest girl. She should be given the same consideration if she was kidnapped. And then Kunstler went on to say that Charles Manson and Lynette and Squeaky Fromm were simply victims of hysteria, that Manson was actually insane, and that Squeaky Fromm didn't have a fair trial. There was suppression of evidence in the Fromm trial, enough to declare a mistrial for Fromm if she hadn't been a Manson girl. Well, the fact that she stood inches away from Gerald Ford and pulled out a gun, she didn't have a double. That was Squeaky Fromm, although there are many doubles around. And she wore that bright red hood. She was so conspicuous, like a Red Riding Hood, and pulls a gun out in front of the President of the United States. That we've had one assassination and one accident at Chappaquiddick, and George Wallace was shot at the Maryland Shopping Center. And he says she couldn't have a fair trial. I don't know what Kunstler wanted or why he's taking this side of Manson and Fromm and Emily and William Harris, because it's through Squeaky Fromm and the CIA that I feel that Patty's life is in danger. So I watch Kunstler, and time and time again, his statements really are nauseating to me, but they're even more than that. His defending Squeaky and the Mansons and saying that they're really nothing but hysteria. I don't understand. The Manson family created corpses down in Los Angeles, you know, six in one home and two in another, a woman pregnant, screaming for her life, and other bodies buried on the ranch of the Manson family. And to be associated with them is plenty, and to be part of all those murders and blood is plenty, and Nazi swastikas, you know, carved into their foreheads. And Kunstler is saying that Squeaky Fromm is just a victim of hysteria. We don't have many overt, violent women like that walking around, and I don't know where the hysteria is. Nobody put her in the park in front of Gerald Ford, or if they did, she's a victim of that. But then go into that. No one was out to get her blood or guts. She had the gun in her leg. She pulled it out, and she missed, but she tried to shoot. She wasn't a victim of hysteria. She was a victim of her acts. And why is William Kunstler defending Emily and William Harris and Squeaky Fromm at this time? I'd really like to know that. Another sad part of the SLA story that is never gotten into is Walter Scott. August the 18th, 1975, this was 3 years ago, an article in the San Francisco Chronicle saying a curious piece of the Patty Hearst puzzle came several weeks ago. It came through the father, John Scott, 66-year-old, and Jack Scott, 33, his wife, Mickey, and their brother, Walter, 42, who's an ex-Marine. The curious episode still puzzles the authorities, because an anonymous informer called Scranton, Pennsylvania police and said the SLA fugitives were in a house near Scranton. 3 days later, the FBI went into a farmhouse where Jack and Mickey Scott had taken Patty Hearst. The FBI disclosed that the Scranton informer had been Walter Scott, and the FBI immediately began looking for Jack Scott and his wife, Mickey. Walter Scott, who called the police on the tip-off where Patty Hearst was staying, and then remember, that's the summer when the FBI had increased their numbers to thousands and were breaking into every van and every Volkswagen, every commune, allegedly looking for Patty with black wigs, braids, short hair, long hair. The chase ended in Pennsylvania in that summer, and then Walter Scott went into the protective custody of the FBI and told damning stories about his father, John, and his brother, Jack, and they put him in a mental institution. The San Francisco Chronicle said Walter Scott was a computer specialist. He worked for Washington firms with government contracts, the father explained. He was twice divorced, a paid informant for the FBI and various U.S. intelligence agencies. Well, what happened to Walter Scott August 18, 1975? Mickey and Jack Scott were later located, but they have never been charged with taking Patricia Hearst to Pennsylvania and back and costing the taxpayers about $3 million in extra agents that summer. But pretty soon, in November of 75, there's an article that shortly after that Walter Scott is suicidal, and that they lived in Las Vegas where Patty had been taken before they went to Pennsylvania. He was taken to the South Nevada Memorial Hospital after the police were called, and he was put in the mental department. This story was that he was suicidal, or that he was shooting out at the swimming pool, and pictures of his brother and his wife, and they put him in a psychiatric ward for observation. And in the apartment were a lot of memorabilia of the Patty Hearst case, and they were scattered all over the place. Walter Scott was put in there for mental observation and November 1975, and it'll be 3 years later in another month or two, and I take 10 papers a day. I never yet have read about Walter Scott or where he is today. Maybe fill up my file and find out, or write to the FBI. Remember the famous Dita Beard in 1972, of April 72, who had an ITT memo that Jack Anderson broke about the ITT putting up hotels and giving $400,000 to Richard Nixon's campaign in San Diego in exchange for using their hotels for the convention. Well, Dita Beard was taken to a hospital in Colorado, and flowers sent by the President of the United States. The carnations had bugs in them and wiretaps, and an agent was sent to court the daughter and see their son and her son. and there are photographs of her with tubes in her nose in this particular hospital. Where is Nita buried today? Martha Mitchell is taken, injected in California, we were told that she was discredited or drunk or silly, and a few years later she died of a miserable cancer where her bones all dissolved. Does Walter Scott have cancer yet, like Jack Ruby and Martha Mitchell? Has he had a lobotomy? Certainly his brother and sister-in-law never were bothered by the police department on this case. Now, he claimed also, besides being a military intelligent, that he was a hitman for the CIA. He worked as a hitman for the National Security Agency, not the CIA. The agency that recently a law was passed, nobody can be prosecuted who works for the National Security Agency. And he said he had been in Egypt, and he did contracts for killing. This is the Earth News story, October 3rd, 1975. I get paid for killing people, and I get them good. I've been doing it for 8 years, and I'm still alive. I recently killed 3 people in a hotel room in Cairo. Well, that's enough to get Walter Scott killed, for sure, and push him over the end, the deep end. Also, at the time of the Patty Hearst story, when the Harrises had Patty Hearst, there was an article in the San Francisco paper, a Harris inventory, they got a tax refund. They had kidnapped Patty, and she was in there in the custody of the Harrises, but the United States Treasury Department had sent a rebate of $146.80 to the Harrises, and the FBI refused to indicate who received the refund check. I have just 10, 20, 30 articles here. I'll run down some of the points as fast as I can on the SLA that came out in the news that I have never discussed on these tapes with you but are in my files. One was the house where Patty was picked up with Wendy Yoshimura. I mentioned briefly on the other side. 625 Moore Street was owned by Raymond Ray. 20 years work with the San Francisco Police Department, Bureau of Identifications. And when they asked about him and they'd rent the apartment, he said in quotes, "I guess I lost my cop's eye, and as an ex-police officer, I'm dumbfounded that he rented it to Patty Hearst and Wendy Yoshimura, and they were living in a house owned by the San Francisco Police Department, Bureau of Identification, Mr. Raymond Ray." The house was also a safe house. The owner of the apartment where they were arrested 4.5 months later wasn't even rented. There's a safe house at the end of the street here where I live, at the end of the cul-de-sac. I'm very familiar with them. They stay empty, and then a family moves in, and they don't fix the yard or the house or paint or put anything on the walls, and they just simply stay there until they get an assignment, and then they move out, and somebody else moves in. This house was empty and it wasn't fixed up. The rent would be $180 monthly rent. But at the time the investigation came out that this police agent owned the house still wasn't rented. Comparison could be made to Lee and Marina Oswald living on Neely Street in Dallas, Texas. And an agent upstairs who moved in the same date as Lee Harvey Oswald and moved out the same week, who worked in the intelligence operation with Lee Oswald, they both moved out the same week. It was a duplex, and after they moved out, the apartment was never rented after April 63. When John Kennedy was assassinated in November 63, people went to the building. The only one who had access to the building was the FBI or the police department, and it was in that house in the backyard where these pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly were taken, but where the body of somebody could be standing out in the yard and then the head superimposed like Oswald said it was, because nobody used the property. Some people must be very rich, and they don't need their income property after these agents live there, or else it is used as a safe house. Mickey and Jack Scott, the two people that took Patty, were going to be investigated by the grand jury into possible harboring of fugitives. So Jack Scott had a press conference and pronounced that they were being harassed by the FBI, and no indictments, of course, ever came down against the Scotts. All they got was a new book published. They've been touring and giving lectures and interviews on a book that they got published. They're called activists, sports activist writers, who had their own foundation before the Patty Hearst story and are immune from being arrested. And I think through the court system of the SLA, even, you can see the comparisons to Nazi Germany, where all the people involved that ordinarily would be in jail 4 years, it wouldn't take 4 years to get the Harrises charged with kidnapping. Wendy Yoshimura is still out. Stephen Celaya, who helped get the apartment in San Francisco where Patty was arrested with Wendy Yoshimura, perjured himself in Sacramento at the time of the Carmichael Bank case. Stephen Celaya had a double. His father worked with the FBI and tipped off where they were. He was let off of the case completely, and so were all the other people, even though a murder was involved. Robin Steiner was identified as a CIA agent by Donald DeFries just before he was killed. She'd come to California with Russell Little from Florida. She went back to Florida. She never was called before any California grand jury or investigated about her links with Russell Little when they went from Florida to Pennsylvania. That not only was the state where the safe house was, where Patty Hearst was kept after she left California, but it was the state that Colston Westbrook came from and Willie Wolfe came from and many other intelligence people. But Robin Steiner came out here with Russell Little and never came back after all the deaths and the trials to be a witness. James Browning, the prosecutor of the Patty Hearst case, was just dying to get this case. He had said in the newspaper, "This is the one case I want to get." The San Francisco Chronicle had an interview with him in January 1976. He was vice president of Young Republicans, California Young Republicans. Charles Watson had worked with them and various other agent provocateurs in that group. Watson was the man in the Manson family that actually did the killings in the house. He was a federal employee. He worked for Republican causes. He worked in a crusade to fight the Vietnam draft resistors. And then, of course, all the people against Patty were down bringing these refugees, Vietnam War people, back into this country. He was handling civil rights complaints and welfare cheaters and monitoring what he called terrorist activities. He was concerned, like Richard Nixon was, he said, with the New Left. He went to special meetings of the criminal investigation in 1970. That's when the FBI COINTEL program and the CIA Operation Chaos could be getting the groundwork to get those people who, from 67, 68, 69, the hippies, the dropouts, the anti-war people, the Berkeley free speech movement, the Black Panther movement, the United Prisoners Union, Vince Ramos, United Farm Workers, those were the people that had to be slammed down and infiltrated. He worked with Nixon. As I said, he was worried about the New Left because they were critical of those crooks in the White House. And he refused to prosecute that narcotic agent that went up to Humboldt County and shot down this young fellow in his home. The helicopters landed. They shot him on a false raid and left. And James Browning wouldn't prosecute that case. And he ended the Indian occupation of Alcatraz. The Indians wanted as a symbol of something they could hold on to. It's not that great, and it's pretty windy, and it's a tourist trap. But he cleaned the Indians out of there. And Mr. Oakes, the Indian that was holding the island there as a symbol of the Indians even holding on to any little piece of rock, was murdered. And the people that murdered him got off, and Dave Browning, I don't know if it was in his area or not, he had kicked the Indians out of Alcatraz, and Oakes was murdered, hit on the head with a cue stick and had brain injuries. And then in another area later, he died from a outright attack that killed him. He survived the first surgery. Browning was a major in the Air Force Reserve until 1972. And, of course, Evel Younger is a general in the Air Force Reserve. And I just wonder if the Young Republicans and their Air Force work and their counterintelligence operation against the New Left and the criminal conspiracy section, how briefed Mr. D.A. Browning was to handle these cases. He also threatened the Berkeley City Council in November 71 if they passed sanctuaries for Vietnam deserters. So you have a very political right-wing fascist group against the kids, against the Indians, against the left, against the hippies on the commune, not prosecuting for cases of murder, but going out after Patty and not prosecuting the Harrises for 4 years. I There's just so much on the SLA. As I say, it's been 4 years since I wrote the SLA is a CIA, but I think from these last two tapes on both sides, you get the idea that I still believe what I wrote in 74, even more so, and I would like to someday get a publisher and do the first story and then the follow-ups of it to keep you up on this. The story of Stephen Celaya has never really been told. He harbored Patty Hearst, too. He called it love, not politics, in the Washington Post, but he was never charged with getting an apartment and moving them from Sacramento into the San Francisco area. Everyone around Patty was danger, and they're all immune from prosecution. And Wendy Yoshimura was given money by right-wing groups in the Japanese community, and her art was sold to the federal building, and she's still not in jail. And she kept the apartment where Patty was until they were arrested. We'll go to Evil Younger, and then maybe I will get back to more to Patty Hearst, because the story really hasn't been told.